The What in God's Name Summer Replay is a three-part trilogy. Today's replay, Trilogy 1, Part 1, Social Justice from a Theological Perspective, Part 1 of our conversation with Kathleen McTeague, which aired on January 30th, 2020. Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shana Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
We're doing theological and philosophical reflections on current events and culture. We invite you to 25 minutes of thinking, putting your thinking caps on. And then when you're done, give yourself a reward. Shana suggested last week that after we're done with 25 minutes, go get a marshmallow. Do you have a different suggestion today?
Yeah, because I figured most people actually don't eat. I think I'm the only person I know who actually eats marshmallows. So, no, I recommend going for something that feels extravagant.
Shana, we got an email from a listener. Last show, I talked about encountering Alexa for the first time, and she was listening to the show. And I said, on the show, Alexa, play What in God's Name podcast. And when I said Alexa, in her car, Alexa came on and did something. Like, I didn't even know Alexa drove cars.
Apparently she does.
So I was wondering if I said, Alexa, at the next light, turn left, if people's cars would go
to... Yeah, I'm not even sure we should record that on the show, Chris, just on the off chance that it works.
We have a lot of material to get to today, but I did want to pause for a second to reset our show as quickly as I can without gliding over too much. We're pushing back against the ways the political and economic modes of thinking dominate public conversations, dominate so much, Shana, that, and so uncritically that we're not even aware how our thinking gets conditioned by political and economic categories. And so we are offering and asking you, our listeners, to come with us and join us in using theology and moral thinking, moral philosophy, moral reflection, to open up more creative ways to understand what's going on in the world.
What in God's name is happening?
What in God's name is happening?
That's terrific, Chris. I love that. Today, we are going to begin what is a four-part series. Of course, any of the series can be listened to by themselves. But we had a wonderful interview with Kathleen McTeague from the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee and Unitarian Universalist College of Social Justice. It was such a wonderful interview, we decided to break it down in three parts. In part one, which we're going to cover today, we're going to take a look at what is the difference between service work and justice work.
Shana, I just want to add as a footnote for our listeners that the first part of our interview with Kathleen focuses on the Unitarian Universalist denomination, and I would just hope don't be deterred by that. If you're not a church person, you're not into organized religion. While our listenership is diverse, including people of faith, people of no faith, we are united in our core values of be curious, go deep, and shine light.
And with that,
shall we listen?
Let's listen.
And we hope you enjoy this conversation.
We're here this afternoon with Unitarian Universalist Service Committee's Director for Activism and Justice Education, Reverend Kathleen McTeague. In the interest of transparency, I should probably confess that Kathleen was my minister way back when, played a key role, really, in my call to Unitarian Universalist ministry. A central aspect of Kathleen's ministry has always been rooted in advocacy and faith-based organizing. She played a critical role in the state of Connecticut around the issue of marriage equality, if memory serves me, and also adoption. I remember you being very active in the Love Makes a Family movement. Her Master's of Divinity degree is from one of our Unitarian Universalist seminaries, Star King, out on the beautiful West Coast. And she also has a bachelor's degree in economics from Stanford University. So, Kathleen, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Shana. Good to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, because that organization has a great, its history is a great story. And then a little bit about your role there and where that dovetails into the UU College of Social Justice.
So the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee began life as the Unitarian Service Committee, because this mouthful of a name denomination that we have, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, is the result of a merger between the Universalist Church and the Unitarian Association of America. They merged in the early 1960s. But during World War II, so well before merger, the Unitarian congregations, in particular the denominational headquarters, began to become aware of what was happening to folk of Jewish origin in Europe. And they sent one of their ministers over to find out more precisely what was going on. We obviously had very few channels of news. So he went with his wife. The Sharps, Waitstill and Martha Sharp, went over to see what was happening in Europe. And they discovered the kind of genocide that was already underway at that time. And they ended up staying there for a number of years, rescuing probably as many as 1,000 people from some of the Nazi-occupied territories. They're among the very few people who are not Jewish, who are written onto the Wall of Memory, I think it's called. I can't remember. In Israel. Because of the work that they did in saving lives. I think it's the Wall of the Righteous. What's it called?
I'm pretty sure it's the Wall of Memory.
In any case, the work that they did with refugees and helping people to flee the violence became a longstanding commitment then within the Unitarian faith. So after World War II ended, it became clear that the denomination had a commitment to an ongoing role with refugee resettlement, with refugees who continued to have to flee from countries that were suffering war. The service committee, in almost a consistent incarnation, has existed for almost 80 years now, which is a very long time for a nonprofit to be around. And when the two denominations merged, it became the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. So its work has expanded. It's not only focused on refugees, but it remains, refugee work remains a very core component of UUSC's focus. What's a little different from what many denominations have is that the UU Service Committee is not primarily focused on resettlement of refugees. There is some involvement on the part of our congregations and our congregants in helping people who need to resettle. But UUSC's focus is instead on the structural injustices that force people to flee in the first place. So it is not primarily a service organization, despite its name. It's primarily a human rights organization, and that's how it defines itself. So to give you an example of how its work is now manifesting, the easiest place to kind of talk about the flow of involvement and the strategy UUSC brings forward has to do with Central America, which we're very involved in because it is, of course, a United States catastrophe, right? The crisis at our border, but also the United States involvement for over 100 years in the Central American countries in very destructive ways that's driving that flow of people. So UUSC's strategy toward this refugee crisis has three components. One is the right to remain safely at home. And so within that bucket of activity, UUSC supports human rights organizations that are driven by grassroots folk in Honduras, in El Salvador, in Guatemala, now, unfortunately, also in Nicaragua. And so the people who are fighting for their rights to be able to live in peace, to be able to live without murder, to be able to live without the threat of violence all the time, those human rights organizations UUSC supports through grant making, but also through sending volunteers, for instance. The second component of that strategy is the right to safety on the migrant trail. So in that bucket of activity is support for Mexican organizations who are dedicated to the human rights of Central Americans who are flowing through their country. And then the third component is really the human right to migrate and the right to asylum, which is an internationally recognized right. The United States has signed on to international treaties declaring our intention to give refuge to those who need it. And, of course, President Trump is operating completely counter to those longstanding commitments of ours. So UUSC is supporting human rights organizations in this country that work directly with migrants at the border and in other places.
I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the difference between service work, which is what I think most of our congregations are involved with, and the work of the UU Service Committee.
So service learning, the problem is in the language, right? We are going to serve and we are going to learn. Well, whoever it is you're going to go visit, it becomes an object then, right? These are not people with agency to solve their problems creatively and to take initiative and to demonstrate their resilience. They are poor people. We are going to go help. That's the problem with the terminology, and it's often the problem with the reality as
well.
We've
talked about some of that on our show, that service from a place of noblesse oblige. Those of us with more to give will go serve the little people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And obviously, people who go do it with the best intention in the world. And I'm not at all critical of that intention. But what I was interested in doing was seeing whether or not that impulse to help, which is in all ways a good impulse, whether that impulse could be harnessed to the work of justice instead of the work of service. And if it's going to be harnessed to the work of justice, then you've got to be in right relationship with the people you hope to help. You've got to actually listen to their solutions and find out if they want your help to start with. And then if they
always
do,
a good place to begin.
What kind of help do they actually need? So that's one thing, thinking of it that way. It's a way to counter the impulse, which is sometimes called the white savior complex, because by and large, the people who go are white, and by and large, the people they're trying to help are brown or black people. So right off the bat, you've just got some issues you've got to deal with. So we tend to think of our programs and to name them instead as experiential learning or immersive learning programs. The other issue I had with the way that the service learning programs were being talked about in the beginning is that they were all focused out of the United States. And I was like, there's something wrong with this picture here. You know, you do not have to leave the American city in which you live in order to come face to face with the consequences of racism, face to face with the horrific consequences of the wealth and poverty divide in this country.
So true. Yeah.
Right? And face to face, therefore, with institutional injustice. It is not an accident when people are in that level of poverty and need. It is not an accident that people like me are comfortably off, that I went to Stanford, right? I mean, there are these big divides in our country. And if we remain unaware of them, then we're in danger of going into one of those experiences and coming back home after a week or 10 days in New Orleans or in Haiti or in downtown New Haven, where you and I used to live, feeling great about ourselves.
Yeah.
And having learned nothing about the structural injustices that have led to the hardships that we have witnessed.
Not only not having learned about the justice issues that were all around us in the place that we were attempting to provide service, but I think also once the revelation of injustice, the structural injustice, becomes manifest, it's pretty easy to get overwhelmed, right? In the work. I mean, in other words, one does not have to be oriented towards a protracted struggle to do service work. But if one's going to do justice work, that's a longer arc, if you
will.
It's
a longer arc, and it has to be engaged in quite differently between people who are not suffering directly the impact of the injustice and those who are directly suffering it. And for us, the shift is thinking in terms of a real partnership. And when people are coming from a place of privilege and they want to engage with a community that has been shoved into the margins or is in other ways being oppressed by systemic injustice, then one has to begin with the question, where are you all trying to go with this? Where are you pushing as hard as you can against these forces? And you need or want allies to come push alongside you. That's partnership, where you're listening for where they want you and you're willing to say, or you're willing to hear them say, actually, thanks, but no thanks, right? I mean, the answer may be no. So if people are going to engage in genuine partnership, they need to listen for where the partner's solutions are and what the partner is saying about what they're trying to accomplish and whether or not there's room for an ally. And then it is, what do you need? So that's another example. There are lots of people who want to go volunteer somewhere. But what happens if what you do is respond to the volunteer's need? In other words, respond to people who come to you, let's say as an example, who say, hey, I'm a retired English teacher, and I'd like to go to Haiti and teach English. So if you're responding to that volunteer's need, you are perpetuating the exact same cycle of privilege, right? It's the person who has all that privilege who is somehow dictating the terms of this experience that they want to have. Again, however good intentioned it is, you can cause damage coming from that place. So we have actually sent over 150 volunteers now to the border regions in Mexico over the last, like, less than 2 years, over the last year and a half or so. But those people are Spanish speakers, and they have been requested by partner organizations at the border who know how to use them and who have set the terms. So, for instance, there's a partner organization in Guadalajara that's called FM4 Paso Libre. FM4 Paso Libre wanted us to send Spanish-speaking volunteers, but they wanted a one-month minimum. So there are fewer people who will go to FM4 Paso Libre, but when they go, they're going to be committed for a full month, and they've got to be Spanish speakers. So the impulse is coming from the receiving organization because they know what they need. We're listening to them tell us what they need. And then we look for those people. We look for the kind of skill set that they say they want.
Kathleen, I'd love to explore the concept of justice with you for a little bit. I was struck when you were talking about the shift of language from service learning to justice and foregrounding the concept of justice in the way that you conceive of and deliver and offer your programs. What is the deeper foundation of justice from your perspective?
Yeah, so that's a deep philosophical question that I think people have probably written many volumes about, but I don't think it has to be terribly complicated because I think we have an instinct toward it. When we talk to our children, my husband and I have three kids. When we talk to our children about justice when they're little, we don't tend to use that word. We use the word fairness. We talk about what's fair. And when we try to help them understand, I mean, kids understand absolutely instinctively the thing that's happening right in front of them when it's unfair, whether they feel like they're being treated unfairly or they see someone else being treated unfairly. The size of the piece of cake, who gets to play with the ball, someone who got yelled at when it wasn't their fault. I mean, they totally get that, right? So the step up from that with children is helping them understand that sometimes there's whole categories of people because of the country they live in, because of the color of their skin, because of the language they speak, because of the religion they adhere to, who are treated unfairly, who are not treated like other people are in a particular country, in a particular society. And so to me, that's just fundamental. You know, it is a core tenet of Unitarian Universalism is that no human being is more worthy than any other, and that no human being is disposable. And so that's our guiding light. You cannot discriminate against people unfairly, right? You cannot treat classes of people as though they are less than human, or this class as though they are less human than that group, right? And you cannot treat human beings as things.
So what I hear you say that caught my attention was you see that the human being, somewhere deep inside of us, or maybe it's not so deep, somewhere inside of us, or part of who we are, is to have that sense of fairness.
That's what I think. And I think that because that's how I've experienced it. I think that I never kind of outgrew my childhood awareness of fairness and unfairness. Is not to say that I've always acted on it. I don't know any person who always acts on their impulse toward fairness. But it feeds my sense of indignation when I see structural injustice that systematically treats categories of people unfairly.
You know, that makes perfect sense to me because, and I wonder if our listeners can kind of relate to this, if I have been treated unjustly, I don't want somebody who's going to come in and say, oh, poor Shayna. You know, poor Shayna. I want somebody to come in who's going to say, wow, that is so unfair. Because once I get that it's unfair, now we're on the same ground. And I think that's, you know, what you were alluding to before vis-a-vis, you know, the partnership, partnering with people who are, you know, on the receiving end of injustice.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think people need, before anything else, to hear an acknowledgement, you know, that what has happened to them is not only unfortunate or awful, but that it is unfair. It shouldn't have happened. right? And then you can start, you know, now that you have acknowledged that, now you can start asking me, what would you like to do about it? What can I do to help?
Shana, one of the distinctions that Kathleen drew, and I know that it was something that you've thought a lot about, is this distinction between service and partnering, which she associates with justice. And I would love to hear some of your reflections on that.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, so I worked for a summer as one of the chaplains for the College of Social Justice and was introduced to this notion of justice ministries for the first time. And it was an eye-opening experience because, like probably many of our listeners, I had engaged in a lot of service work and had engaged in some partnering work as well, but had never made the distinction. So by making the distinction between service work and partnerships, you know, without the distinction, it's kind of hard to choose. Or even, you know, without the distinction, you don't even begin to think about it. And my hope is that our listeners today, in hearing the difference of these options, begin to think for themselves, how are they being called? Because if you don't have the language, you may not be able to sense or interpret the call.
There really is a difference and a distinction to be made. And I think Kathleen did that very well, the distinction between this sense of, I'll come in and serve.
And then, the risks in service work where we can objectify those we go to help. I mean, she makes some very pertinent observations about things like, it is normally people who are white-skinned going in to serve those who are darker-skinned. And, you know, we bring with us the thing we feel called to provide, whether or not they've asked for it. That's obviously not our intention, but I think we have to have our eyes open when we do that work. Then there are obviously times when you don't have time to ask those questions. Service work is needed, and it's needed now. You know, you get a community that's flooded and a community that's been wiped out. Yes, we need hands down there.
I'd like to shift the conversation to social justice, if we can. So I've been thinking about social justice for a while, and I have a genuine question, which we may not be able to answer, but I do want to just lift it up. In my mind, and I think in a lot of people's minds, social justice is a synonym for left-wing political agendas. Why is that the case?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question. I have never experienced people on the right engaging in something that they called social justice, and it may just be how we name things. I mean, you know, for example, for those who are pro-abortion, they probably feel that this is a social justice issue, but they would never frame it that way because they're probably going to frame it in religious language.
Just a second ago, you said pro-abortion, but I think you meant pro-life. But I can't believe you said that because I have written right here on my paper, I was going to raise that with you. And full disclosure, I did not say that to Shana before we came on the show.
He did not, but the longer we do this show, the closer our heads are to becoming one.
So. Well, that is the great example. Like, why don't we consider abortion to be a social justice issue?
Well, and again, I think because especially where the abortion issue lies, the people on the right are so grounded in religion that they're using religious language, and social justice is a more secular term.
Is that right? Like, that's interesting to me. I never really thought of that. I thought social justice was a religious term. So I did a little kicking around in this because I'm fascinated with the origins of these kinds of ideas.
Because you're a dork.
Because I'm a dork. You are quick to remind me of this. So here's an interesting thought that relates to this. I can't even read my handwriting. Dang it. Taparelli. He was an Italian Jesuit in the middle of the 19th century, and he talks about the natural sociability of humans. So by nature, we gather, we make societies. That's obviously not an original observation about human nature.
But although it may have been in the middle of the 18th century.
Yeah, maybe. And then he goes on to say social justice. He used the phrase social justice. Now, he's Roman Catholic in the Jesuit order. And his definition of social justice boils down to this. This is not a direct quote, but basically he says, you don't get for yourself without getting for everybody else. You don't desire and get for yourself without desiring and getting for everybody. And so that's a definition of when a society is working well and is just.
Yeah, and it takes me back to the interviews we were doing on the line at the Trump rally. One of the observations we made was how many people who identified as Trump supporters who were of a mindset that if it's working well for me, then it's working well. And, you know, not seeking to look too much further past that. Now, to be fair, the old school Republicans did not think that way.
It's a basic conservative tenet that...
It's where the conservative party has gone today. But, you know, if you go back to the Rockefeller Republicans,
it was... Right. No, yeah. What I'm saying is that philosophical conservatism emphasizes community connection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not this libertarian individuals for themselves. That's the way it's become. Burke, Chesterton, others, which I consider kind of classical political conservatism, it's about the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is so much more to say about this. I think I would like to do a show on social justice with you to explore some of these things, because there's more to be unpacked here. Loved this conversation with Kathleen. Part one, as you say, of what we're going to do with the interview that we had with her. You've been with us for 25 minutes of hard thinking and good reflection on public questions. So reward yourself with a marshmallow, if you so choose.
Or an ice cream sundae, or whatever it is that floats your boat.
You can check us out at our website, whatingods.com. That's WHATINGODS. Click on how to listen, and you will find buttons there to sign up, where you can receive What in God's Name wherever you get your regular podcasts. We're also on Facebook at What in God's. Good to be with you, Shana.
Always good to be with you, Chris. Have a great day, everyone.